This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Your number is 877-217-5757. Signature support is provided by First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. And we start our show today with State Representative Edward Ted James II. Edward Clark James is a person who's very active at the Capitol, and we're going to get his view of what happened last week as the veto override session was a disastrous failure for the Republican majority. Today's story, a fine one in The Advocate, above the fold from Sam Carlin. They don't have the votes inside the frenzied veto override session. Before we get there, though, I think Ted James has a personal story that warrants retelling about his near fatal experience with COVID-19 last year. He was hospitalized, and it didn't look good for a few days. And we have this surge in cases now, and with the cases go more hospitalizations, and now almost 11,000 people in our state have died from COVID-19. Representative James, your thoughts about the fact that the Department of Health is reporting the numbers are identical. 36% of African Americans have been vaccinated, 36% of whites have been vaccinated in Louisiana, meaning almost two-thirds of our population has refrained from being vaccinated. What do you think?
It's extremely disappointing, Jim, I'll tell you. Especially in the African-American community where this virus has, taken so many of our friends and loved ones, and, the impact that it's had in our community is so disappointing that the numbers aren't higher. But I also recognize that there's a lot of distrust in the African-American community around vaccines. And, and so we've been working extremely hard to try to get the word out, not just in the African-American community, but all across the state, especially with folks in my age group, because I know that the reluctance, I hear it a lot with those from, 25 to 45 and 50. A lot of reluctance and this wait and see what happens. And the numbers now are showing that a lot of the hospitalizations, they're not older people in our community. They're folks my age. And, you would think that my story would motivate people in my age group to do what they need to do to protect themselves and their family. But it looks like we just have a lot more work to do. I do appreciate that the vaccine numbers have gone up over the last week and a half. And I don't know if that's just the surge or if that's the lottery that the governor announced, but we got to continue to make sure that folks are getting vaccinated.
What do you think the biggest reason is why people are not getting vaccinated? In the white community, it's thought that by many that President Trump is a culprit, but he got vaccinated, of course. In the black community, you say there's some mistrust. What is the root of that?
I think that the Tuskegee experiment, I hear that a lot. I hear the fact that the vaccine was developed so fast. I know that there are some folks that still think that this whole thing is a hoax. And you hear it largely in the white community, but I'm not going to say that I haven't heard it in the black community as well. I would hope that now we have folks like Senator Cassidy, who is a physician, who is, urging folks to get the vaccine. You got Congressman Scalise, who has shown the world that he's been vaccinated. You would hope that some of these individuals, because one of the biggest disappointments with COVID is that it became a political issue. And I think that plays a huge part in, number one, we knew folks that didn't want to put on a mask. So if you didn't want to do something that simple, those are probably the same folks that aren't getting vaccinated. And as I hear and get information and text messages about family members of those colleagues that I have in the legislature, I know the ones that, have not worn a mask. You would think that the ones that don't wear a mask, their families probably aren't wearing a mask. But, we get these text messages of family members of my colleagues who are in need of prayer, and COVID is not discriminating. So some of those same families that are in need of prayer are connected to my colleagues that have not worn a mask and thought that it was wise that we open the state back up prematurely, and have fought against vaccine mandates. So you would think those things would turn the tables, but obviously they haven't. So, you know, deaths like Luke Ledlow and Steve Carter, you would think those things would, you know, motivate people to go and take care of themselves, but they haven't. So, you know, at this point, Jim, I don't know what will motivate a family or, you know, individual that hasn't taken that step yet to do so. You know, the hospitals here started to show numbers yesterday with their hospitalizations, and they broke them down, you know, vaccinated versus those individuals who aren't vaccinated. And the numbers are clear. They were, you know, 239 unvaccinated and 32 vaccinated in Baton Rouge, General Ochsner, and the Lake. You know, that's all the information I would need to see to take the step to protect, you know, my family. You know, my little girl, we had to get her tested yesterday because there was an outbreak at her school, at her day camp, I mean, summer camp. So this thing now is impacting children. And if you don't want to do it, you know, for your children, do it for my little girl, you know, your neighbor's little girl, because, you know, now young people are being impacted and they can't. At four, she can't get vaccinated. So let's do something to protect the babies.
877-217-5757 for Edward Ted James, State Representative, Democrat from Baton Rouge. And yesterday in The Advocate, Tyler Bridges had a story. He polled the congressional delegation, and three members, Clay Higgins, who's had COVID twice, and several members of his family as well, Garrett Graves, and Mike Johnson, all declined to answer whether they had been vaccinated. And I'm taking that as a no. They probably don't want to say that they have not, but that shows here we have members of Congress, Higgins, Graves, and Johnson, who apparently have not been vaccinated, Ted. How can we get past the sentiment that you're talking about, this mistrust, when people who should know better are not acting appropriately? Ted James? All right. I think we may have lost Ted for a moment, Katie, so let's see if we can get him back. So it is a mess out there, as Representative James noted. 16 months into the pandemic, Louisiana's hospitals are battling against a ferocious uptick in COVID-19 without a full complement of their most precious resource, that staff, to care for critically ill patients. Front page story, Blake Patterson and Emily Woodruff. We're past burnout, says Kathy O'Neill, Dr. O'Neill, the chief medical officer at Our Lady of the Lake Regional Medical Center. And I was talking about some members of our congressional delegation who have not acknowledged that they have been vaccinated. And I think if they had, they would say, certainly I've been vaccinated. They have some obvious trepidation, or they would be vaccinated. And yet, we have this case in which we're trying to get more people vaccinated. We won't have herd immunity unless that happens. Ted, this is a danger zone. It's serious business.
No, it most certainly is, especially with the fact that one of the members of our congressional delegation would not be a member, but for, you know, her husband dying from COVID, right? That in and of itself should be enough reason. Right now, Congressman Higgins, he's in need of prayer. His wife is in need of prayer, and he hadn't taken the basic step. And when you have, you know, folks that are elected and who should be leading us out of this, you know, it's hard to convince individuals to go out and get the vaccine, because what it says is if that person, a congressional member who probably has access to a lot more information than I do, if he isn't getting it, then that means something must be wrong. And we know that it is easier to not trust something than it is to trust, especially when it comes to government. I know that and I understand it. You know, and I don't know what to do with those folks that have, you know, refused to. And I agree with you. I heard what you were saying when I got, when I fell off for a second. If you're not saying, then I'm taking that as a no, that you haven't been vaccinated. Because at this point, there's a fine line between, you know, privacy and, because I went through it myself. When the moment I tested positive, my dad, he told me you need to, you know, make a statement and let people know what's going on. And I told him, you know, he and I, we had a huge difference in opinion because, you know, for males, like, this is my health, it's personal. And I give up too much of my private information being elected, but my health, I'm going to keep that personal. And I didn't recognize how important it was for folks to know and understand, especially early on, that somebody young, because at the time it was only a disease for older people with certain health conditions. And, you know, I didn't check any of those boxes. So I didn't recognize, you know, at that time in March of 2020, how important it was 2 weeks into this whole pandemic. But now, a year plus later, I don't think that elected officials have that same excuse, and they should be taking a first step to protect their family and then urging others to protect theirs.
877-217-5757. We'll go to the phones with Ted James. We'll also get his review of the veto override session after this 90-second pause. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 for Representative Ted James. We had a close COVID call himself, is urging people to get vaccinated as the fourth surge is spiking and hospitals are overwhelmed. Patrick in Innisfail Estates, you're on the air with Representative James.
Hey, I'm conservative. You know that from my phone calls, but I did get the shot. I got the first shot. I still got to get the second shot. For me, it was partly the lottery. I mean, that was an incentive. The Delta D thing rising. And then, you know, Donald Trump's the one that got this vaccination right away. And that, you know, I really don't know why a lot of conservatives are against it. I guess because they don't like government telling them what to do. But I think, you know, this also goes back to, like, you know, autism, unlocking autism. They've always been against vaccines. They blame vaccines for autism. So this isn't the first time people have had a concern about a vaccine. And
all right. Thank you, Patrick. Ted, would you respond, please?
No, I agree with Patrick. You know, I know that, you know, not just conservatives, but there are Democrats on the other side that don't like government telling them, you know, what to do and what not to do. And I get that. And, you know, I think Senator Cassidy was on yesterday or the day before talking about, you know, because I think the next step is going to be requirements that you're vaccinated to fly, to go to certain places. And I know that that's going to cause a huge uproar. But he pointed out so eloquently on the news that this is not new. You know, for your young people to go to school, there's a requirement for them to be vaccinated, you know, to go to college. We had to, you know, get, you know, certain vaccines. And I think that, you know, we're going to have to wrap our arms around and our brains around the fact that, you know, this is not going anywhere. And, you know, people keep saying that, you know, talking about COVID in the past tense. And I know that there's a lot of fatigue out there. I mean, I have it. I, you know, have started to, you know, wear my mask again. And of course, I don't want to do that. But the only way that we're going to ever get on the other side is that, you know, people like, you know, Patrick go out there and get the vaccine. And I'm glad to hear that, you know, it was the lottery, because I know that the governor and LDH talked for, you know, a month or so about incentives, and there was some reluctance on certain individuals about, you know, putting incentives out there. But, you know, Patrick is proof positive that those things are motivating factors. So I'm glad to hear that.
Laverne on I-10. Laverne, you're on with Ted James. Hi.
Good morning, gentlemen. Jim, I just want to say that I think the media has had a certain hand in sowing some doubt in the CDC guidelines all along the way. Last night, I heard Judy Woodruff on PBS NewsHour question Dr. Fauci about this latest change in the masking requirements, and then go all the way back to when we weren't required to wear a mask at the very beginning of the pandemic. This is a different disease right now, and people just need to really kind of listen to our scientific leaders. Thanks.
All right. Thank you, Laverne. Well, Ted, as we know, we see the same thing with climate change. Some people just don't want to believe what's right in front of them. There is no climate change. That I hear that quite a lot from people who should know better.
That's right. You know, and Laverne is right. And one of the things that, and it is an unfortunate issue with COVID, there is a lot of uncertainty. And, you know, even, you know, the CDC, they're learning different things, and their opinions and guidance is going to change. But the one thing that's constant that has not changed is the fact that people are dying, right? So listen, look at the numbers, right? You know, to mass, not to mass, the age groups, you know, different things, you know, surges are going to, you know, require CDC to modify guidance. But what one thing that has been very consistent from the start of this thing is that people are dying at high numbers. And that should be the motivator. And like Laverne said, you know, even, you know, the journalists and folks that we listen, that we see on TV every day, those folks are not the experts.
Rose in Mid-City. Rose, you're on with Ted James.
Good morning, gentlemen. When the AIDS crisis came along, our government went and started telling people that if they had AIDS and they gave it to somebody else, they were committing murder. Why is it that we are not seeing this the same way?
It's an interesting point from Rose. Ted?
Oh, yeah, Rose, that's a very interesting point. And I think that the fact that COVID has been so politicized, we have so many people that are elected that refuse to take this thing seriously. And, you know, and to the point where we are, you know, real serious and it's not a politicized issue, I don't think that we're going to get to that point. But you know, certainly, you know, putting your loved ones and your family at greater risk of being, you know, hospitalized and or dying. But, you know, with this being so highly partisan, I don't see it getting to that point.
Jay in Mid-City. Hi, Jay. You're on with Representative James.
Good morning. So why is such a conservative effort for the black community to take the shot? There's a lot of other groups in this country having to take the shot either. You know, then have anyone looked at the illegal immigrants that have came to this country in the last several months, you know, with not knowing these people have taken the shots, they have the immunization shots, and the other requirement you spoke about with showing proof to get on an airplane or go in the store to shop grocery, that's just a sign of the beast that's coming. Thank you.
All right. I couldn't hear everything you were saying, Jay, but how far can we go as far as government mandates, Ted?
You know, I think that we could go as far as we are brave enough to go. I know that, you know, folks in my circle that were reluctant when there was a concern that airlines were going to start requiring vaccines, folks went out and got the vaccine because they were tired of being at home. If LSU football says you have to be vaccinated to get into this football game, trust and believe the numbers are going to go up because we are so hungry to get back to life as normal. And, you know, we are limited in that because folks simply won't get it. And, you know, the question about the, you know, the focus on the African-American community, you know, I'll tell you, you know, my focus is because I've seen what it has done. I've seen the alarming numbers of how it impacted, you know, the African-American community as far as the, you know, folks migrating here. I think that that's certainly something that, you know, Congress and, you know, the Biden administration should be looking into instead of putting these folks in cages and, you know, debating about what to do with them and that path to citizenship. We should at least make sure that once they're here, they receive the, you know, the proper, you know, health care. And if it's, you know, they need to be vaccinated, before they are, you know, invading, either Texas or Louisiana, all these border states. I think that that's certainly a concern that, you know, folks on the federal level should be looking at.
877-217-5757. We're getting lots of folks wanting to talk about this, and we will get to the veto override session. Tim in South Downs, another one waiting patiently. Tim, you're on with Ted James. Hi, Tim.
Thanks, Jim. Yeah, I wanted to ask Representative James. We've heard a lot from some state leaders and the Attorney General in particular that state law prevents vaccine mandates in public institutions. And I was just wondering, as a lawyer himself, if he could point to that law.
Is there a law to prohibit that, as Jeff Landry insists, or could it be done?
Well, I for one don't trust Jeff Landry's guidance because he politicizes too many different things that shouldn't be politicized. You know, Louisiana is an at-will state. If your employer decides that they want you vaccinated, I think that that's just cause, a good cause for you to be terminated. On the state level, with those folks that are non-civil service, I think that those appointing authorities can mandate that they receive the vaccine. Those folks that, that are civil service, I do question whether or not there's the authority to do that. And what's going to happen is somebody's going to have to challenge it. Somebody is going to have to. We're going to see if the state government goes down that line and you know, makes that a requirement, then, you know, of course, somebody's going to challenge it. But, you know, I do, I see some private government, private institutions, I definitely think that they could mandate it with the state. I think that, you know, maybe some issues there with those that are civil service and have civil service protection.
We'll be back with Ted James after this pause for the news, and I promise we'll also get his take on the veto override session back after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Please be brief in your remarks to State Representative Ted James with us one more segment. Gail in Pointe Coupee Parish. Gail, you're on with Representative James. Hi, Gail. Good morning. All right, let's try Tim in Thibodeau. Tim, good morning. You're on with Ted James. Hi, Tim.
Thank you, Jim, Representative. Simply, how much did the veto session override cost?
All right. What was the cost of the session, which went nowhere, Ted James?
I think it was like $16,000 per day in the Senate and about $60,000 per day on the House side. So, I mean, you know, complete waste of taxpayer dollars from start to finish.
Henry at the Country Club. Hi, Henry. Oh, Henry, we lost Henry. Let's go to Jim and Walker. Jim, good morning. You're on with Ted James.
Good morning, gentlemen. What I'd like to know is why we are not treating and talking about treating COVID-19 vaccinations in the exact same way that we treat tuberculosis and vitamin K. With tuberculosis, if you receive a diagnosis, you must take the treatment. If you do not, you're put under house arrest. If you break your house arrest, you're put in jail until you are clear of tuberculosis.
Sounds like Jim is recommending drastic action. It may take this, but we do live in a country which values freedom to make choices. Although many who are saying they want freedom to not be vaccinated, they certainly don't want to allow a woman to have the freedom to determine whether she would have the right to suspend or end a pregnancy. Ted James, we have a lot of questions that need to be answered. Bill Cassidy, once again, is coming across as the voice of reason on a sensitive issue. Why aren't the other members of our delegation, John Kennedy, Garrett Graves, Clay Higgins, of all people, Steve Scalise, where are they now? Where's Mike Johnson? Where is Julia Letlow? Why aren't they out there shouting from the rafters, get vaccinated?
Yeah, Congresswoman Letlow, she has, but just her platform has not been elevated enough as it should be. I'm happy to see Senator Cassidy step up. You know, I don't know what's taking so long for the others, but, you know, back to even Tim's comment, it's too politicized. And, you know, until the folks that we have elected get some courage to really address this issue head on, we're going to continue to see these issues. But, you know, folks are hopefully listening to Senator Cassidy on this as one who has seen, you know, as a medical professional, he's seen things firsthand.
As far as the veto session, they don't have the votes. The headline today in The Advocate, Governor John Bel Edwards worked this mightily and was successful. He needed to keep the number below 70 to override his veto of a transgender prohibition bill. And Ted James, you were on the front lines. You have talked about how on the other side, now Governor Edwards has been singled out for using strong-arm tactics. They were using strong-arm tactics on the other side too, weren't they?
Oh, most definitely. This was, you know, people can't complain about politics being at play in politics. There are a lot of different promises, threats made, you know, all around. And I think that, you know, from the governor to, you know, the House and Senate leadership, those are things granted to them when they get appointed to those top positions. So it's always easy to complain when things aren't going your way. I mean, it's just like the old saying, ain't no fun when the rabbit has the gun. But, you know, the threats and promises were, you know, equally levied on both sides.
And several listeners have sent emails, far too many to read. I have had a few listeners chide me saying Julia Letlow has tried her best to get people vaccinated, and for good reason. She lost her husband, mm-hmm. and we commend Congresswoman yep. Letlow, who is a doctor, a PhD herself, an educated mm-hmm. person. Interestingly, mm-hmm. that she has, I believe I'm right, a PhD, and we have two members of our delegation who don't have college degrees, and neither one of them is vaccinated. 877-217-5757. Ted James, you have been singled out by the other side for remarks made after the session. Why are they taking after you?
Truth hurts. I think that I have not said a single thing that is not true. I have, you know, defended the speaker, you know, from day one. And, you know, the same folks that are telling him to remove me from my chairmanship were the same folks that criticized him for working with Democrats to get elected. You know, the state party has never been a fan of the speaker. The hayride has never been a fan of the speaker. And, you know, I know that the folks that are naming me in emails now don't want me to start releasing text messages from the many times that they wanted to form an allyship with the Black Caucus to try to remove the speaker. Now, you know, I won't ever do that. But, you know, the folks that are throwing my name out there and placing the blame at me certainly don't want me to start fighting back. Because it's one that I'm confident that I'm going to remain standing very tall at the end of this fight.
So if they try to take action against you, you will respond. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, most definitely. Like, I'm not going to start the fight, but, you know, I'm not going to run away from it either. You know, and I applaud them for trying to use this failed veto session as a unifier. And had they gone to the speaker and not attacked him the day after he was elected, we probably wouldn't have gotten to this place. But what they did, they criticized him. They called him a rhino. They said he wasn't Republican enough. And now they've seen what happens when one side is unified. They should have taken that route from day one. Now, you know, if I'm the chair of criminal justice committee, if he removes all of the Democrats, that still does not get them to 70 votes, right? So, you know, me losing a parking spot, me losing a chairmanship is not going to silence me. And it's certainly not going to help them get to the magic number. And that number is 70. So they want to use me to unify the party and raise money, have at it. But it's not going to solve the problem. And the problem is they can't get to 70 votes.
Governor Edwards took this personally. Why?
I think he should. You know, most governors, you don't want to have your veto overridden because it takes away all of your power. And this was an exercise in that. You know, for a bill that is meaningless, hateful, and would have cost us millions of dollars, that was number one to test whether or not they can override the governor for larger issues like redistricting that actually matters. And I think that it was an issue to really weaken the speaker because they knew that getting a 70 was largely impossible in the House. You know, and I've heard red stories about certain folks that have committed both sides. You know, people change their mind all the time. So this is not new. You know, going into the session, someone probably would have said, hey, I'm with you on this override. And then they learned of the fact that the LHSA already has this rule. They learned about, you know, the fact that we were probably going to lose the Final Four and certain things like that may have changed their mind. And that's a part of the process. People do that. Now, I would hope that if you committed to either side that at least before you sat in your chair to make that vote, you communicated that. For me, if it was my bill, I would have wanted at least a heads up before I brought it to the floor. But I think that no matter what, they had pressured us so much to have this session that the vote was going to be taken no matter what. Because for me, I never saw a tick sheet that had 70 votes. And, you know, I thought that it was an exercise to do just this, cause this type of ruckus, this drive a further wedge. But what is shown is that the other side, they're a lot more divided than we are. And I think that that's going to, you know, benefit us going into a redistricting session.
Well, and there we go, redistricting. We have this weird configuration with North Baton Rouge being in the district represented by Troy Carter in Greater New Orleans. And if North Baton Rouge were in the 6th District, quite likely a Democrat would be elected, as maybe somebody named Ted James. What are your thoughts about how there will be a move, but most believe it will not be successful, to move North Baton Rouge back to where it should be?
You know, for me, of course, I don't like the fact that Baton Rouge and even some of the river parishes are in a congressional district represented by, you know, Congressman Carter. I love him to death. I endorse him. But we in the capital region, being the capital region, Baton Rouge being the largest parish, we are rightfully due, you know, a congressional seat. I think that the numbers in this state justify having more than one majority minority seat in Congress. And that's what we're going to be pushing for. And if we don't pass a map that allows Democrats to elect a candidate of choice in more than just one district, I'm going to ask the governor to veto it. And we're going to be right back into this place where they're not going to be able to override it. And either the legislature can go in and operate in good faith, or we can have these maps drawn by the courts. There's only two options, good faith or us conceding our authority to the courts, because it's going to be litigated.
Final caller for Representative James Stewart downtown. Please be brief, Stewart.
Certainly, Jim, James, and the audience. Good morning. Ted, since we all, particularly those in politics and in the legal arena, and you're an attorney, take the oath of "In God We Trust," all of these new sexual isms that are on the horizon, aren't they anti-God? And
all right. Does Stewart have a point, Ted?
He may. My God never told me that discrimination is something that he wanted me to work towards. I think that it's easy to hold on and claim to be so religious. And
okay, we do have to roll, but right after the break, we'll hear from Philip Rucker, the remarkable reporter, after this. This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana in our final segment. Philip Rucker, senior White House correspondent for the Washington Post. He led the coverage of President Trump and his administration as the bureau chief, and he and a team of Post reporters won the Pulitzer and the George Polk Award for reporting on Russia's interference in the 2016 presidential election. His latest work is I Alone Can Fix It, the number one bestseller, Donald J. Trump's Catastrophic Final Year. And for those familiar with Philip Rucker, the pride of Savannah, Georgia, he has written critically about the President of the United States, but unlike most other journalists, even though you wrote a very stable genius, which was not pleasant for Mr. Trump, he doesn't appear to hate you. You have this unusual relationship, and you gained a remarkable access in this book as well. How do you explain that, Philip?
You know, I think I explain it through fairness. I've covered Donald Trump from before he was president during his campaign. I've interviewed him many times. I know him, and he knows my reporting, and he knows that, you know, the conclusions that a reader might draw from my journalism are not necessarily flattering for him always, but that they're rooted in truth and fact, and that I'm fair in pursuing the truth. And you know, to that end, for this book, Carol Lenig and I interviewed more than 140 different senior administration officials, cabinet members, advisors to the president, and then we sat down, of course, with President Trump for 2 hours and 45 minutes down at Mar-a-Lago to make sure we understood his perspective and his worldview to inform the writing of this book.
What was your impression of his demeanor when you talked with him in person after all the stuff that's happened of late?
You know, when we sat down with him, and it was the very end of March, so it was a couple of months after he left Washington and left the White House, he seemed pretty at ease with himself. He was very comfortable talking with us. He seemed to enjoy the conversation, but he was fixated on the 2020 election results. He again and again went back to his claims of voter fraud and that the election was rigged and stolen from him. And of course, there's not been enough evidence to support those claims. That's why so many judges threw out the cases that his campaign had lodged. And yet the president still, former president, still believes there was fraud and believes he was unfairly removed from office through an election conspiracy.
It is interesting. You're saying he believes it. And there are others who believe that he believes it, too, that he's living in a delusional world. But if he believes it, then in this particular case, he would not be telling a lie. He would be wrong, but he would not be telling a lie. Why would he believe something like this?
Well, I think it's convenient for him to believe this as opposed to accepting that he lost the election. You know, there's nothing worse in Trump's mind than being labeled or branded a loser, especially a loser to Joe Biden, who's a candidate Trump didn't really respect and would mock and make fun of as Sleepy Joe. So, you know, to convince himself that there was election fraud and that it was unfair and rigged and stolen from him is in a way sort of an exit for Trump. It's a way for him to leave office without feeling disgraced.
Well, Trump did receive 74 million votes, the most of any candidate.
Absolutely.
In history, except for Joe Biden, who got more than 81 million votes. When did the tide turn for Biden? I think we know it turned when James Clyburn endorsed him in the primaries, but he was thought to be perhaps a poor match for Trump. He's only 4 years older, but some believe he acts older, and Trump, of course, played that up. I'm not sure that's correct, but when did the American people say, I'd rather have Biden than Trump?
You know, I think the American people started to conclude during the early months of the COVID pandemic in early 2020 that it was enough of Trump, that this was somebody who, you know, maybe they wanted to take a chance on him. They liked that he was an outsider. They liked that he seemed to be championing working people, at least in his rhetoric and what he was saying. And yet when faced with a true crisis, and this is what we report on in our book, I Alone Can Fix It, when Trump faced a real crisis, his toolkit of bluster and bullying and bragging did not work to save lives in this country. And a lot of American people, and the polling shows this, started to feel exhausted by the chaos and the drama and the mismanagement and the bungling and the, you know, misinformation about science, and just wanted to have some kind of calmer hand at the wheel and turn to Joe Biden, somebody who seemed to have experience and would govern with a lot less heat and drama than Trump.
The book is I Alone Can Fix It, bestseller from Philip Rucker and Carol Lenning, and they earlier wrote a number one bestseller, and using Donald Trump's very own quotes, a very stable genius. And Donald Trump did sit down with them for almost 3 hours and talked with them, and despite the fact that they'd written a book critical of him. Do you think he reads the books?
I don't think he reads. I don't think he reads the books cover to cover, but I do think he pays very close attention to the news media coverage of books about him, and may read some of the excerpts. And, you know, our book, I Alone Can Fix It, has generated a ton of news coverage in the last 2 weeks, in part because of all of the news revelations in the book. And so they clearly have gotten the former president's attention. Trump has issued a number of statements attacking the reporting in the book, although it's worth pointing out we fact-checked everything in there with him and with his office. And to this, you know, date, he's not said anything is inaccurate.
Well, he is a person, as you acknowledged, who does not want to ever admit a mistake or certainly a defeat, and he has not acknowledged his defeat to Joseph Biden. He hasn't even acknowledged that Hillary Clinton received almost 3 million more votes than he did in 2016. What is the biggest revelation in the book? And there are many, as you note. Each day, it seems, brings a new story based on your reporting. What surprised you, the man who's been at the scene with Donald Trump since the beginning of his presidential quest?
You know, I think I was most surprised by how much worse things seem to be behind the scenes. I mean, I covered this presidency day in and day out for the Washington Post and had a lot of access to the president and the people around him and felt like I had kind of that front row seat to what was happening in real time. But it wasn't until Carol and I did our deeper reporting, our excavation, really, our investigation for the purposes of this book after Trump left office, that we learned in talking to senior officials that things were actually scarier and more chaotic behind the scenes than we ever knew in real time. And one example is General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He had been concerned. He's the highest-ranking military officer in the country, and he was concerned in those months between the November 3rd election and Biden's January 20th inauguration that Trump could actually use the military as the commander-in-chief to execute a coup to stay in power despite having lost the election, despite the will of the American people wanting a different president, that Trump would use the military's power to stay in office. And that's a chilling thing to think about in a democracy like ours.
You note that the three Supreme Court justices he nominated and were confirmed, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Coney Barrett, he thought they would automatically back him in his challenge of the election. They did not, and he particularly got riled with Kavanaugh. Why?
You know, Trump got riled about Kavanaugh because he thought that this was going to be a transactional relationship. He thought that if because he had defended Kavanaugh during his confirmation hearings, remember, he faced those allegations of sexual assault and sexual harassment. Trump thought that if he had Kavanaugh's back then, that Kavanaugh would owe him, that, you know, now Justice Kavanaugh should rule in Trump's favor on the Supreme Court. But that's a misunderstanding of the role of the Supreme Court and the justices, of course, because they don't rule based on who they owe a favor to or a transactional relationship. They rule based on the Constitution and the law and their interpretation of it. And, you know, in the election fraud claims that Trump's campaign brought forward and that the Supreme Court did briefly consider, there simply wasn't the evidence to support the claims from the Trump side. And that's the reason why the court tossed out those cases, decided not to take them up.
The book is chock full of information, some of which is yet to be fully vetted. But and when I say vetted, I think we know what's in here is accurate, but stories that have not been told in all their glory. And one of those that you go into depth and were there is Trump's close call with coronavirus. It was a close call, wasn't it?
It sure was. And he was sicker when he was in the hospital than I think we knew in real time. And certainly his condition was worse than the doctors communicated in their many press briefings during the president's stay at Walter Reed. I mean, he was really very ill, and he took a series of therapeutic treatments and other sort of emergency measures to get his condition under control. And of course, he survived it and you know, resumed campaigning on the campaign trail in short order. But those few days when he was at Walter Reed in the hospital were very, very risky for his health, and there was a real chance that he may not have made it.
He made it, but he didn't win the election, and Philip Rucker reports it like nobody else. I alone can fix it. Donald J. Trump's catastrophic final year. Thank you, Philip.
Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure. First Financial Tax and Accounting Services provides signature support. Until tomorrow, for Katie Ann McDonald, I'm Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening. Stay safe and stay tuned.